From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Coming up this hour, surveillance and privacy. How do you balance convenience, security, and the discomforting feeling, no certainty, that you're being watched?
If people are asked to give up their privacy, they better get more security in return.
And in the night, basically turned my phone into something similar to an ankle bracelet. So everyone, well, including the FBI, would know where I was at any given moment.
The sort of wishful thinking is, if you do this fairly simple thing, you will not have to do the hard work of protecting your privacy or protecting your data.
So does it matter if Google knows that you're gay? Well, I don't know. Do they have any homophobic engineers with access to that database?
The internet is a giant copy machine. Anything you put on the internet can be copied and sent around. I just hope you have nice friends.
An hour on privacy, or the lack thereof, coming up.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. At no point in history have civilians been more vulnerable to government surveillance or prying by private companies. And what a curious trio of factors have brought us here. Fear of terrorism on the one hand, the profit motive on the other, and on both hands, the fun and convenience of life online. Whether for utility or security, loss of privacy is a trade-off, sometimes conscious and sometimes not, and perhaps the defining bargain of our times.
But is it a bargain as in a good deal, or a bargain as in Faustian? We're devoting this hour to considering the issues of privacy and surveillance. We'll review some of the latest refinements in snooping, online, on the phone, and even on the road. But we'll begin by examining our own illusions. In the next report, OTM producer Sara Abdurrahman may be telling the savvier among us what we already know, but most of us still cling to the notion that we, with a few simple precautions, can handle our own security when we venture online.
In response to the new Facebook guidelines, I hereby declare my copyright is attached to all of my personal details, illustrations, graphics, comics, paintings, photos, and videos. Anyone can copy this text and paste it on their Facebook wall. This will place them under the protection of copyright laws.
If you're on Facebook, chances are that you've recently seen that statement on the walls of your Facebook friends. You might have even copied and posted it yourself. It went viral. But as the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Ava Galperin observes, it was all a hoax.
The sort of wishful thinking that really powers this hoax is, if you do this fairly simple thing, you will not have to do the hard work of protecting your privacy or protecting your data. Often it stems from a misunderstanding about how the internet works or how privacy works.
A lot of our behavior springs from that misunderstanding. We take some measures to protect our data, but they're often the wrong measures. It's like ordering a Big Mac, large fries, and a Diet Coke. The intentions might be good, but we won't get the results we're looking for. Same with that viral Facebook meme. Within hours, countless people wasted time posting it to their walls. But according to Sarah Feinberg, Director of Policy Communications at Facebook, when they actually offered their users a real chance to vote on how the site is governed,
very few users were engaged in the vote, far less than 1% of users. My sense is that many more people were focused on the copyright meme.
Our privacy attitudes and our behavior are much less rational and stable than what we may like to believe.
Alessandro Acquisti co-directs the Center for Behavioral Decision Research at Carnegie Mellon University. He says the more you believe yourself to be in control, the more likely you are to act. The people who posted that bogus copyright notice on their Facebook wall felt like they were in control.
On the other hand, at the Facebook election, I can express my preferences, but really I have no guarantee that these preferences will be satisfied.
Of course, it's not just Facebook. Anytime you use a service from what's known as a third-party provider, you are subject to its terms, and that usually means it owns your data and can do what it wants with it.
So if you're using Gmail, your mail essentially belongs to Google, and Google can decide what they want to do with it. Google has a terms of service and a privacy policy that says they will not give it up, but they're not required to do so.
Galperin says people don't really grasp the lowly legal status of their emails.
And they don't have the same Fourth Amendment protections that they would if the mail was sitting in their house. And governments and law enforcement agencies, even people involved in civil cases, could possibly come to the webmail provider and get that information with a warrant.
In fact, even without a warrant, if your email is older than 6 months, Ryan Single, former editor of Wired.com's Threat Level blog, says that's a byproduct of an outdated law.
When they originally set up electronic privacy law in the 1980s, everybody always downloaded their email. You didn't leave it on the server, so anything over 6 months was considered abandoned. Whereas these days, you leave stuff up on the internet forever in your accounts.
But what if you don't actually send your electronic correspondence? Remember that affair between General David Petraeus and Paula Broadwell? The couple reportedly used a tactic favored by terrorists and teenagers to keep their communication secret. They left their messages as drafts in a shared email account.
Well, the idea is that if you write a draft to someone, you leave it there. The email never gets sent to that person, right? So there's one less hop, which means like one less place for somebody to see something.
But Petraeus and his mistress were found out, so a perfect plan, it is not. And if the director of the CIA can't cover his tracks online, what hope is there for the rest of us?
People often think if they throw something in the trash and delete it, that it's therefore off of their computer. That is not the case. People think that if they erase their browser history, that nobody's going to be able to figure out where they went online. It does make it a lot harder, but it's not impossible to get. Skype is one. People think things are encrypted. It is encrypted, but most of the time Skype saves chats on your computer. People make mistakes about using open Wi-Fi or neighbor's Wi-Fi to do things that aren't legal. The other one I love is that businesses put those little disclaimers down at the bottom of their emails that, you know, this email is only intended for the intended recipient and you can't forward it on. That has absolutely no meaning whatsoever.
So, why do people do it?
Because it can't hurt to add it and it might scare people, but every lawyer I talked to has said, no, that's not true. So if you get an email that's not intended for you and it's got some crazy secret, send it on to the New York Times. You're not going to get prosecuted. If you want to say something to someone that's very personal, pick up the phone and call them or say it in person. The internet is a giant copy machine. Anything you put on the internet can be copied and sent around. I just hope you have nice friends.
The reality is that once you release an email into the world or post a Facebook status or even send an off-the-record chat, you have no control over what happens to it on the other end. And even though many companies that you store private information with online promise not to disclose any of it,
those promises are no good when the rule of law comes into play.
Computer security researcher Jacob Applebaum says even the most well-intentioned company has to comply with the law.
That's happened to me with my Gmail account. The U.S. government took my Gmail with less probable cause than a search warrant would have required by far. That is an example where privacy by policy is an utter failure.
He says the only way to keep companies from divulging your personal information is to encrypt it, all of it, so they can't collect it in the first place.
The trick is to change it from a dynamic where you basically say, please promise not to take this data, please promise not to exploit me, but they do anyway, or they've been compromised so they don't know they're doing it, and takes it to a place where they can log it all they want, but whatever they log is worthless because it's encrypted.
So now it's on you. What a pain. You might think, who cares if my information isn't private? I've got nothing to hide.
So does it matter if Google knows that you're gay? Well, I don't know. Do they have any homophobic engineers with access to that database? For example, in Uganda right now, they're trying to pass what people call the Kill the Gays bill. And that is a great example where today the information about you, which can be found by your social network, that's a life or death issue.
Your online life can be targeted for any number of unexpected reasons. Just ask Wired magazine writer Matt Honan, who recently had his whole digital life destroyed by hackers. They wanted something he had.
They had gone after me because they saw that I had a 3-character Twitter handle, which was sort of valuable real estate. So everything they did was all kind of collateral damage to get that Twitter account.
Collateral damage, including wiping away years of messages, documents, and every photo he'd ever taken of his 18-month-old daughter. Honan's sobering experience taught him that the one thing we all use every day to shield ourselves online, the thing that makes us feel protected and in control, the password, is actually a dangerous illusion.
A password is just a string of data, and there are all kinds of ways to either get around it or get it and copy it.
Honan says a password is especially vulnerable because it is a singular point of entry that can be attacked from multiple fronts, through malware on your devices, large password dumps online, phishing, brute force, or the strategy used to get into Honan stuff, password resets. And a person trying to break into your online accounts can often reset your password using information already available online.
If I call up tech support and I happen to know, say, your mother's maiden name, which I've gotten from Ancestry, or your high school mascot that I've gotten from classmates, or your date of birth that I've gotten from Facebook, I'm most of the way there to getting a password reset.
And you know that password trick we're always told to use, replacing letters with other symbols?
A 5 for an S, a dollar sign for an S, a 4 for an A. If you can think of it, there's a computer program that can do it.
And go ahead. Keep trying to make your passwords longer and more complicated. There are computer programs that can figure those out, too.
It's an arms race between how many characters you're willing to enter in and how good our computers and the programs that we run on them are going to get.
And of course, we all know we're not supposed to reuse passwords in multiple places. But repeating password patterns is no good either.
Some people will do this thing where they'll have a password that could be, say, 123 Google. And they'll think, okay, well, that's my Google password and my Facebook password is 123 Facebook. And so it's totally different. But it's not. People reuse passwords because they don't know how else to remember a good password. This has been the long-time problem with security. People won't take steps to secure their information unless it's convenient.
It's precisely that trade-off of convenience over security that keeps people online.
We can walk down the street and ask Google what's the best place for sushi within 3 blocks. Facebook has been really great at keeping people connected. If you want to have a party and you want to invite people or share photos with all of your friends, like, that's really pretty cool, actually. So it's hard when you kind of balance the things that you get with it with the things that you don't want. Like, you don't know if you put that picture up, who's going to see it? And, you know, how do you keep a stalker from coming after you? Or how do you keep an ex-boyfriend from keeping tabs on you on Twitter?
Anyone can copy this text and paste it on their Facebook wall. This will place them under the protection of copyright laws.
I, for one, did not post that Facebook disclaimer on my wall because I don't have a Facebook wall. Staying off the social networking site is my way of asserting control over my digital identity. But then again, I'm also guilty of using a Diet Coke to wash down my metaphorical Big Mac. I may be off Facebook, but I use Gmail, have a smartphone, communicate over Skype, pay bills online. It's all just too convenient. For On the Media, I'm Sara Abdurrahman.
Coming up, government surveillance is on the rise, but if you've done nothing wrong, what have you to hide?
Or is that even the right question? This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Recently, the Wall Street Journal uncovered a privacy story reminiscent of the days immediately after September 11th. Here's Fox News.
A disturbing new report claiming that the Obama administration has launched a counterterrorism plan to gather information on millions of innocent Americans, including people not suspected of any crime.
Since March, a little-known government agency called the National Counterterrorism Center has been allowed to gather information about you from any government database that it deems, quote, reasonably believed to have, quote, terrorism information. Data like flight records, casino employee lists, or the names of Americans hosting foreign exchange students. While programs like this have been suggested before, they've never been implemented because privacy advocates have persuasively argued against surveillance of citizens who are not under suspicion. Now that that data can be collected and retained for up to 5 years, that argument no longer prevails. Also, now such data can be shared with foreign governments. Wall Street Journal reporter Julia Angwin explained why this represents a dramatic shift in how the U.S. intelligence community looks at its own citizens.
The general guiding principle in the intelligence community has been that surveillance abroad is fine. That's part of their job. But inside the U.S., you generally would want some reasonable suspicion before you started pulling somebody's file. But the National Counterterrorism made a successful argument that they should have that authority to pull entire databases from other federal government agencies, copy them in their entirety, and keep them at the National Counterterrorism Center to look for clues. They used to be prohibited from doing just general searches. Now they got an allowance to do pattern-based queries, meaning that if they feel that a pattern is that your name is Bob and you wear pink shirts, then, you know, they'll pull all those people, and that might be enough to put you on a terrorist lineup.
I should observe at this point for our listeners that I'm wearing a pink shirt, so that didn't come entirely from nowhere. It's a data point. If this program had been revealed in the Wall Street Journal 5 years ago when George W. Bush was the president, there would have been marching in the streets. It would have been, aha, once again, this administration has overreached. There have to be hearings. This must stop. And yet, we have a different administration now, and there's scarcely a whimper. What's going on?
One thing is that by the time that the public learned about this program, it was already signed into law and was in effect. And so there was a feeling of, like, what can we do? Also, politically, there hasn't been a huge will to push back against the war on terror.
You've made what I think is a very trenchant comparison, the digital revolution versus the industrial revolution.
Yes. My hero of all time is Ida Tarbell, who was the leading muckraker in the post-industrial era. And she, at the turn of the century, was writing these stories about Standard Oil and how they had their incredible monopoly over oil and the extreme price gouging they were engaging in. And her series of muckraking articles led to the creation of antitrust laws. And at the same time, Upton Sinclair was writing about the factories and the abuses that were happening in the slaughterhouses. They were really the watchdogs for this era, because at that time there was no OSHA and there were no antitrust laws and there was great change going on in the economy, but there wasn't a regulatory structure to police it. We're at this great moment where the information revolution has come. We've never been more connected, but we are just awakening to the dark side of it, which is this idea that we're going to live under total surveillance all the time and that our speech will be chilled by the fact that we're always worried about who's watching us. Right now, the role we're playing, at least I see myself and my colleagues at the Journal playing, is we're trying to police that, right? We're not saying that the internet is bad or that any of this information economy is bad, but, like, here are the edge cases that we should consider. Where do we want the boundaries to be?
Have we had the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire yet?
I think we probably have not. The Cuyahoga River caught fire 12 times before the Clean Air Act was passed. So I think it takes a lot of repeated abuses before things change.
Julia, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Julia Angwin covers privacy for the Wall Street Journal.
In the ongoing debate over privacy, there's a common refrain that one side loves to repeat. If you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to fear. The phrase was often invoked when the British government decided to install millions of public surveillance cameras across the country. And it's not only the refrain of government organizations. In 2009, Google's then CEO Eric Schmidt famously had this to say about your privacy on CNBC.
If you have something that you don't want anyone to know, maybe you shouldn't be doing it in the first place.
But George Washington University law professor Daniel Solov says that this argument misunderstands privacy entirely.
People think that privacy is just about keeping secrets, when it's about a lot more. It's about basic control over very important information that could have an impact on whether or not you get credit or a loan. You might receive, for instance, different pricing on certain things at the airport. You might be subject to extra screening, and you don't know if it's random or if you're on some list or what the reason is. Things can happen to you based on your information, and you have no idea what data is being used, why, and how. You have very little recourse to do anything about it.
Okay, but what about the classic and persuasive rejoinder that it protects us?
I hear this argument a lot any security measure that's privacy invasive must be really good. And I don't think that's true. One example is the random searches in the New York subway. Out of about 2 million daily riders, they searched a handful of people. This program was an amazing waste of money and time that was largely symbolic. There's a term that Bruce Schneier, a famous security expert, uses called security theater.
Security theater?
Yes. Making it look like you're doing something that's really helpful, but it's not. It often leads to policymakers and others not really putting to the test various security measures and seeing, are they really effective? I don't believe in privacy at all costs, but I do believe that if people are asked to give up their privacy, they better get more security in return.
So do you think we could resolve this issue if we were more transparent about our invasions of privacy?
Yes, I definitely think more transparency and letting people in the know will help. And yet, one of the challenges when it comes to data mining for terrorism, which involves trying to determine whether people are engaged in patterns of activity that look suspicious, is that when you have that greater transparency, you also tip off the terrorists as to what patterns people are looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a tension, and I'm not quite sure how you resolve this tension. There are certain patterns we don't want to have the government using. So what if the government uses things that you might say or read? What if they use religion? What if they use race? Certain things could be put into the profile that we as a society might think is not fair and not appropriate or even prejudiced to put in the profile.
We don't live in China or Iran, North Korea. This isn't a surveillance society. Or do you think it is a surveillance society?
This is a surveillance society. The difference between us and China is that the government there is much more totalitarian. But the tools of surveillance that they have at their disposal are the same things that our government is using.
Really? I mean, we don't block people from getting to certain websites.
We don't block. That's the difference. China blocks, and China censors, and China arrests you in the middle of the night, you know, and throws you in a prison, you know, somewhere, you know, unknown. Actually, we do that too. We just don't do it in the same extreme way that China does. But we do have all the tools of surveillance. You know, we have drones that patrol the skies. We have tracking of the internet. We have the NSA surveillance program listening in on people's phone calls. I don't think that there's a very high risk that our government's going to become totalitarian in the sense that China's government is totalitarian. But what I do think is it could affect certain groups, certain types of activities, and it's hidden. I mean, that has some totalitarian implications, but just for those people. So, hey, if you're not on that list, great for you. But if you happen to be on the list, now you're in a different world.
You said that you're not a privacy absolutist. How would you resolve this issue?
By having real balancing between privacy and security. If we understood privacy better and didn't reject it out of hand, and we actually have real scrutiny over the surveillance, we could have our security and our privacy too.
Daniel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Daniel Solove, law professor at George Washington University, is author of Nothing to Hide, The False Trade-Off Between Privacy and Security. Philip C. Bobbitt is a former director for intelligence programs at the National Security Council. In his 2008 book, Terror and Consent, The Wars for the 21st Century, he argues that data collection is an incredibly useful tool that's fundamentally misunderstood by the public. Take, for example, the alarm over warrantless wiretapping.
There seems to be an assumption in the public debate that warrantless surveillance is lawless surveillance, that the Fourth Amendment requires warrants before you can intercept a conversation or surveil somebody. Well, the court has held that searches in public schools don't require warrants. Government offices can be searched for evidence of misconduct without warrants. Searches can be conducted at the border. Searches can be undertaken as a condition of parole without warrants.
Many legal scholars have found there is Fourth Amendment support for their position that it's illegal. Many have noted that the president has neatly resolved this issue by simply proposing and passing bills that made legally dubious practices legal.
Well, we have a way of resolving these things. We don't put it in the hands of the president. As you say, this is an act of Congress, so majorities in both houses thought it was constitutional. It will doubtless be challenged in the courts, and judges will rule on whether or not they think it's constitutional. This is a statute, and it's either lawful or it's not.
You've also said that the need for warrants reflects an outdated criminal justice paradigm for building a case, and that's not what the NSA and the other government surveillance agencies are doing.
That's exactly right. The warrant requirement is for criminal prosecutions, and that is a law enforcement paradigm that has served us very well. The problem is that if you're trying to preclude an attack, then you're not trying to punish someone for something they have done. You're trying to anticipate an act that has not yet taken place. Let me remind you of this fact. We knew the identity of two terrorists. Al-Nadar, whose name was on a watch list. We had photographs of him leaving a terrorist meeting in Kuala Lumpur, and Al-Hamsi. If we had simply taken their home addresses, their credit card accounts for the purchase of airline tickets, their frequent flyer numbers, and their cell phone numbers, we would have picked up all 19 other hijackers and the fact they were all flying within an hour and a half period on September the 11th. Now, it's not a crime to buy an airline ticket, but we would have prevented that atrocity just by cross-hatching the information we had on these other 17 with the two men we did believe were terrorists.
Yeah, but those people were already flagged. One of them had left a terrorist meeting. Looking up his associates would seem to make perfect sense, even if the rules then prohibited it. But we're talking about a massive sweeping of information. I mean, the Wall Street Journal has just reported on another set of rules recently implemented that allows the National Counterterrorism Center to examine the government files of U.S. citizens for possible criminal behavior, even if there's no reason to suspect them. And that's apparently new.
I don't see what the National Counterterrorism Center would be doing with these, as you say, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of data points, if they were not trying to connect it to known terrorist activity. How would they get a start? How would they ever navigate through this incredible maze of information? The only way that that kind of data mining makes sense is if you already have some strong lead.
A few minutes ago, we heard from George Washington University law professor Daniel Solov, who's worried that information that's collected about us for one reason could be applied to some other unrelated purpose and that we'd never know.
He makes an excellent point. I'd go one step further. I'd say that we ought to be using these very sophisticated techniques of automatic data mining and cross-hatching to protect privacy. The cross-hatching, initial looking for patterns, ought to be done by machines so that no one knows anything about any particular person. The retrieval of that information with an identity ought to go before some exterior tribunal to show there really is a hard data point that justifies that.
You would advocate anonymizing the data until a suspicious pattern emerges and not putting a name to the data until there is some oversight from a different body.
Absolutely.
He's also concerned that the government might use criteria to build profiles that we as a people have deemed inappropriate, like, say, a person's race or religion, and that it could be used to target certain groups.
In light of some of our past abuses of power, that also is not an unrealistic fear. And I think we have to address those fears the way we have in the past by building in legal processes and now building in technological processes that prevent that.
I guess it all comes down to trust in government. When this data exists, it can be abused.
Yes, that's right. Now, the question is, do you decide that there's nothing we can do other than simply not use these data mining techniques? And I think that that's a very unrealistic and I think not a very helpful way to manage the security of our people.
So do you believe that it is essential?
I certainly do. Abdul Muttalib was the underwear bomber. And a subsequent Senate investigation into his plot showed that the National Counterterrorism Center did have hard information about it. that the problem wasn't a failure to share intelligence among the various entities, but that the National Counterterrorism Center was not organized adequately to fulfill that mission because it did not query other government databases. Remember, this is not information that's collected by the government without your consent.
Casino employee lists, the names of Americans hosting foreign exchange students?
Yeah, that's right. This is information that we have provided the U.S. government. It's not information they went out and surveilled us to find out. And that is, I believe, the political impetus for this most recent round of trying to integrate government information. Unless you're prepared to say that data mining is useless in these areas, when it so clearly could have prevented 9/11 with the most rudimentary techniques, then I think you've got to move on to those other questions. What can we do to give our people confidence that it's not being abused? But what I sense is bewilderment as to why the Congress would pass this statute in the first place. They get a barrage of rather hysterical attacks, some of our major newspapers, and perhaps even in programs like this one.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, the statute was passed by big majorities in both houses. It was a bipartisan act, and the persons who supported, for example, the FISA reform, are among the most respected people in American life.
Some say that it's just political death to appear to be pulling your punches on terrorism, that the majority would rather vote for somebody who would stop at nothing to prevent terrorist acts, even if it seemed to roll back assumptions of privacy that Americans have.
Well, if the public wants to be more secure by changing their expectations of the data that is now brought to all of us across these new technologies, that seems to me to be a pretty sophisticated decision.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Philip Bobbitt, law professor at Columbia University, is author, most recently, of The Garment of Court and Palace, Machiavelli in the World That He Made.
Coming up, why one man's response to undue government surveillance has been to surveil himself.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the Internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Gilchrist Foundation in support of NPR's commitment to coverage of the arts, the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. There is a legal device that is used by the U.S. government to obtain personal information about citizens called the National Security Letter. These are essentially subpoenas with a lifetime gag order attached, a serious gag. I mean, you can't tell your lawyer, you can't tell your business partners, or even your family. Out of hundreds of thousands of recipients, only 3 people have ever won the right to disclose that they got a National Security Letter. Chief among them, Nicholas Merrill, the owner of a small internet service provider called Calix in New York. I spoke to Merrill in 2011 and asked him to tell me about being on the receiving end of a National Security Letter. So paint me a picture here. I mean, is this like a Law and Order episode deal where someone says your name in a locker room or something and you turn around and he throws you an envelope and says, you've been served?
It was a little more formal than that. I was at my office. It was 2004, and I got a telephone call. The caller told me that they were with the FBI and that someone would be coming by my office with a letter for me. Soon enough, I found out that it wasn't a joke when an actual agent did arrive and handed me an envelope. Inside, there was a 3-page letter. You can actually view it at aclu.org/NSL. And basically, the letter ordered me to produce information about one of the clients of my ISP.
And what do you do next?
What I did right at that very moment was simply read the letter. You know, a number of things leapt out at me. The first thing was completely absolute commandment that I was never to tell anyone.
Not even your lawyer?
Your reaction just now was very close to my reaction. I looked at the agent and I said, not even my lawyer, not even my business partners. And the agent just kind of shrugged.
All right, so what happened next?
The agent left. I tried to make sense of it all. One of the first things that I was looking for was a judge's signature or which court this supposed subpoena had come from, and there was none. So I called my attorney, my feeling being I'm an American and I can always talk to an attorney and no one can tell me that I can't. He was a bit taken aback, and coincidentally, one of the clients of my internet service provider was the New York branch of the ACLU. So we got in touch with them.
So not only are you not telling anybody, now you're telling everybody. You go to the ACLU and they advise you what?
They told me they had never seen one before. And at that point, I knew that this was really, really serious. And I started to wonder, what had I gotten myself into?
Did you comply with the other parts of the order to turn over the information to the FBI that they were seeking?
No, I never did.
And the court ruled in your favor, but not entirely. What was the gist of its decision?
It was the first time anyone had ever challenged any of the powers from the USA Patriot Act. The court ruled two separate times that the national security letters provision is unconstitutional and a violation of the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, and the Fifth Amendment.
Before we get to the current legal disposition of your national security letter, let's talk about the government's concerns. Let's say one of your internet clients at the time was a terrorist. Obviously, you would not want to tip such a person off that the feds were on the trail. So, you know, if not a secret subpoena, what is the solution?
It seems to me that the existing tools, such as normal subpoenas from a judge, are workable. Numerous terrorism plots have been broken up using those types of tools. If we don't have checks and balances, then we're really, I think, going down a dangerous path. And the purpose of having a judge listen to the evidence from law enforcement is to provide a check on their power.
Okay, so back to your disposition. You ultimately won the right to disclose that you had received this letter, but you didn't win the right to disclose everything. And in fact, even as we speak, you are holding in your lap a laptop with a 6-page single-spaced checklist of things you are or are not allowed to say lest you wind up in Leavenworth. How ungagged are you at this point?
The way I try to explain it to people is that if before I was partially released from the gag, there were 100 things I couldn't talk about. Right now, there's probably 97 things that I can't talk about. The main things that I won the right to say are that I was the plaintiff in this case and that I received a national security letter. During the 6 years when I couldn't say anything, I couldn't tell my family, I couldn't tell my fiancé, I couldn't speak to my elected representatives. Basically, it forced me to sometimes even lie to people. That was a real problem for me. Now that I can at least say that I was the plaintiff in this case, it is somewhat of a relief. But at the same time, people ask me things that I can't answer. I mean, I've been warned that I should be really careful because anything I say is probably being listened to, particularly public statements. I respect that even within the privacy of my own home because it's a huge risk.
It turns out that you're kind of a poster child for a very large group of people. Do you feel a burden of responsibility that you're speaking for this gigantic cohort of the gagged?
Between 2003 and 2006, around 200,000 of these letters went out. That works out to be nearly one letter per 1,000 Americans. Although you're allowed to challenge the gag every year now under the new revised law, the last time I did it, the government presented secret evidence that only they and the judge could see, and my attorneys could not see and therefore could not challenge. It does kind of add up to a lot of responsibility, and that's part of what motivated me to start my nonprofit organization, the Calix Institute. Part of it is to defend people who are gagged. Part of it is also to promote best practices among telecommunications companies in regards to the privacy of customer data.
Nick, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Nicholas Merrill is the founder of the Calix Internet Access Corporation and of the nonprofit Calix Institute, which works to put encryption tools solely in the hands of ISP users. Thus, an ISP would have no access to readable client data that a national security letter might demand. So, we move from the most secret of secrets to what may be too much information. Increasingly, law enforcement agencies all over the country are using license plate readers, car-mounted infrared cameras that capture the license plate numbers and the date, time, and location information of every car they pass in order to catch violators in real time. But even if you obey the law, your whereabouts at any moment in time could well be being logged by these cameras. In August of this year, I spoke with Eric Roper of the Minneapolis Star Tribune, who filed a couple of Freedom of Information Act requests for license plate reader information. Turns out, never mind the cops, anyone and everyone has access.
What we found is that 4.9 million plates have been scanned in Minneapolis just in 2012. The vast amount of the data is on people who have not violated any laws but are just driving around the city. You can make a request of what happens to be now public information. So the information on my car, which I requested, we received a number of data points that the police had kept over the course of a year, but also the information of the mayor of Minneapolis. His information was also public. There isn't a state law, and this is the case in most states, governing how we keep this data, how long. So it's left up to local law enforcement agencies who can use it as they see fit.
Now, the principal use of this is to find people without standing warrants and stolen car reports and so forth. To your knowledge, have the police used the data to investigate an individual who they are interested in for perhaps something more significant than traffic fines?
The police have said that they do use what's stored in that database to help them with investigations. An example that they provided to me was they were looking for a suspect and looked at his license plate reader data and found that he was parked at a certain location repeatedly. That gave them a place to begin in trying to find him.
Hence the impulse to keep the data for a year instead of 2 days.
Exactly.
On this program, we are almost reflexively in favor of sunshine, that whatever the government's collecting, the public should have access to. But it frankly terrifies me that as a private citizen, I have access to essentially the tracking records of other private citizens.
Well, and that's what's so ironic about this program is that it's not something that people generally know about. But here in Minnesota, that data is public. And now each state will depend on records requests there to find out whether the state open records laws preclude any of that. But you find that there's almost too much transparency when it comes to license plate data on a program that we haven't known much about up until now.
I mentioned the availability of this data to third parties. Now, that might mean a reporter interested in where the mayor's been, and it could be someone whose business has an interest in where your car is at any given time. You know of one such case.
There was one car dealership that sells cars to people with bad credit who those people had stopped paying for those cars and now it was trying to repossess those cars. So some repo men were looking for their cars and figured this was a perfect opportunity to do that.
But what's troubling is there might be people even more sinister than repo men, people operating outside the law, who might have an interest in my driving patterns.
Right. And one of the most prominent voices on this, who is a chief information officer for our public defender service, he brought up the examples of ex-spouses and stalkers and people who are looking to burglarize people. I mean, he really feels like there are some major public safety implications here.
So which of On the Media's hobby horses should rise to the fore here? Should it be our sense that personal privacy is sacrosanct and that nobody should surrender it by accident, especially to the government? Or should it be that government transparency should be the overriding social good, and therefore if we surrender a little privacy in the bargain, it's no big deal? Or is there some middle ground here?
I think the first step here with regard to transparency is having a public discussion at legislatures, at city councils, at the federal government level, perhaps, about this technology. And so that at least allows people to understand what's out there and how it's being used. From there, decisions can be made about whether it's private or public, how it can be shared. You know, I think transparency starts with having a public discussion. And so that basically seems to be just beginning.
Eric, many thanks.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Eric Roper is a reporter for the Minneapolis Star Tribune.
And now we move from what may be too much information to what definitely is too much information, by design. In 2002, artist and professor Hassan Elahi was detained at Detroit Metro Airport by the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Somehow his passport had triggered a terrorism alert, and he spent the next 6 months in and out of interrogation rooms, sharing every detail of his life, which, as a compulsive record keeper, he had. Thanks to that wealth of personal information, he was cleared, whereupon Elahi began TrackingTranscience.net. He calls it an experiment in self-surveillance. Essentially, he inundates the FBI and the rest of the world with his personal data. When I spoke to him in 2011, I asked him to start by telling me what happened when he got off that airplane at Detroit Metro.
It was absolutely something out of a movie. You know, I come out of the airport, I hand my passport over to this guy, and he blanks and then takes me through this rat maze at the Detroit airport. And I'm in an INS detention facility. And it was there I was met by an FBI agent. And the FBI agent asked me all sorts of details about who I was with, why I was there, who pays for my trips, every little detail. Then he asks me out of nowhere, where were you September 12th?
2001?
Exactly, yeah. This was in June of 2002, so it was shortly after. They had received an erroneous report that an Arab man had fled on September 12th who was hoarding explosives. Now, never mind I'm not Arab, never mind it wasn't the 12th, never mind there were no explosives there. But, you know, we're going under this approach that, well, if you have a Muslim name, then you must be Arab, and if you're Arab, then you must have explosives. I think he realized that I was no threat, and he let me go. He said, well, I'm going to pass this on to the Tampa office. They're the ones that initiated this. They'll follow up with you, and we'll get this cleared up.
And you asked him for a letter stating that you weren't guilty of any crimes, but the FBI wouldn't give it to you.
I travel a lot, and as an artist, you know, you go wherever there's work. So I said to him, guys, all we need is the last guy at the last airport not to get the last memo, and here we go all over again.
Why wouldn't he give it to you?
Well, the problem is, in order to be formally cleared, you have to be formally charged. As Americans, we tend to think that, you know, we have these rights and these proper legal procedures. But when it comes to terrorism and national security, frankly, all that goes out the window. And in this case, there was no law. So at that time, they couldn't really issue a statement of any kind. So they said, well, you know what? If you get into trouble, here's some phone numbers. Give us a call. We'll take care of it. I would call the FBI and I would tell them, hey, this is where I'm going. Not because I had to, but I chose to. I started creating this little device that would share everything about me. And then I basically turned my phone into a tracking device, into something similar to an ankle bracelet. So everyone, well, including the FBI, would know where I was at any given moment.
And let's talk about the sort of stuff you sent. Random hotel beds you'd slept in, parking lots you'd parked in, photos of tacos you ate in Mexico City between July 5th and July 7th, pictures of the toilets you used.
I've come to the realization, guys, you want to watch me? That's fine. I'm okay with that. But you know what? I can watch myself better than you guys ever could. And that's what was really exciting about this project, is that it really turns this surveillance upside down on its head. Intelligence agencies, and it doesn't matter who they are, all operate in an industry where their currency is information, and it's the restricted access to the information that makes that information valuable. By me borrowing the simplest of all economics principles and flooding the market, the information that the FBI has about me has no value whatsoever. There are so many different databases that go up there. I'm hoping that the viewer has to go through the role of playing the FBI agent and cross-referencing this database with that database, and in that detective work, coming to the realization, wait a minute, this could be me.
And then what are you supposed to conclude?
Hopefully, we'll come to the idea that We're in such an absurd age, the way we think of government surveillance, the way we think of wiretaps. And the only way you can really counter such an absurd system is by going even further absurd with this. I mean, when you're looking at my photos and you're seeing all the toilets and all the food and all the beds, there is a sarcastic, comedic side to it. But at the same time, I'm talking something incredibly serious. Instead of actually fighting this, I can comply, and maybe even to the point of aggressive compliance. And by doing that, it actually neutralizes this whole situation.
And yet, you've written that your server logs indicate repeated visits from the Department of Homeland Security, the CIA, the National Reconnaissance Office, and the Executive Office of the President. You have everything out there. So what are they looking for?
You know, this baffles me. Maybe it's just someone being curious. Maybe it's just, hey, check out this guy that's doing this wacky project. But on the other hand, what if it's not? The hits are frequent enough to make me concerned. It's hard to say you're paranoid when you actually have proof that they indeed are watching.
Hassan, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Hassan Elahi is an associate professor and interdisciplinary artist at the University of Maryland.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Doug Anderson, with more help from Krista Ripple and Annie Russell. And it was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Ken Feldman.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
But don't tell anybody.
Your secret's safe with me.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.